dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with Benjamin Boyce, who is an American YouTuber who does a lot of interviews and other content, and he's also on Twitter. Benjamin, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Benjamin. I've been doing this YouTube thing for almost 8 years now, 7.5 years. It started when my college blew up, the Evergreen State College, where Brett Weinstein got his start in the middle of a race war, you know, intersectional meltdown. And then I just kind of hit the ground and got inserted into all these different discussions. And I've been mapping out different... I like to map out the edges of the Overton window, so-called, mostly on the right side, because that's where I feel either most at home or most where most of the possibilities going on lately.
Yeah. Would you say that the mainstream culture is inherently left, and that's why it's of less interest?
You know, I think, yeah, it's, you know, I'm attracted to what hasn't been talked about or what you're not supposed to talk about. You know, I grew up in church and my mouth would say things that you're never supposed to say because, like, I don't know why, like, something in me, like, would be drawn to thinking or saying the thing you're not supposed to say because there's some sort of charge there that's, for whatever reason, one reason or another, is just glossed over or created by people who don't want to look at that direction or talk about that thing. But yeah, for whatever reason, I think we have a hard time defining what left is. I'm always trying to figure out what we mean by the left, but I think it does have something to do with where the elite and the structure is right now, is kind of coded left. Do you have insight into that?
Like, well, the previous guest is someone who was until quite recently a leftist, and I think for her it was we were talking about the 90s, and I think in the 90s you could. It would be harder to see that the establishment is left wing or is left coded or even that it was liberal, like progressive. But it, mm-hmm. Certainly post 2010, that's obviously true. And I think yeah. It was true before then as well, just in very cloaked terms. I mean, there's a reason why rock and roll happened. There's a reason why punk happened. There's a reason why 90s rave happened. There's a reason why the sexual revolution happened and the permissive society happened, you know, all of that. So,
So you remember the 90s, personally?
Vaguely.
Yeah. I had a paper route and I would listen to Rush Limbaugh in the morning. And so I knew that the mainstream culture, I knew that he was right and the mainstream culture wasn't what he was. He was talking about things in ways that you're not supposed to, in ways you're not supposed to, and things that you're not supposed to talk about. So I think he did a lot to define, in my mind, in my imagination, what the left is and what mainstream culture was, because he was never, even though he would be really popular, he was very good at his job, he was never included in, you know, in discourse. I remember nobody ever wrote about him. And then they finally did a spread, like Time magazine or Life magazine finally did a spread on him. But it was way past like when you thought he would be deserved to be boosted, but they just ignored him until they couldn't ignore him anymore. So left is always defined by what's not left in my mind.
All right. I see. And at this point, where would you say the establishment, the left. I think throughout the 2010s, this definitely took shape. That it wasn't just that the establishment or the power center was leftist or progressive. It was that it was insisting on a doctrine of leftardism, which got ever more shrill. And part of that was the censorship online. And I would like to talk briefly about that because it does, it's relevant to both you and me because I was I started in 2014 and I was banned in early 2021. And then thereafter, a new crop of channels emerged. it was already happening before I was banned, but it's something that's obviously, there's a post-alt-right YouTube. There's a post-alt-light YouTube. And I don't say that in any disparaging way at all. But how would you say this has evolved recently? Because obviously we talk about leftist regime enforcing by way of deplatforming people, debanking people, defunding people, enforcing a certain doctrine. And then I would say about maybe a year, 2 years ago, it seemed to peak. What would you say about that?
I hope my audio is okay. Your audio got bubbly, just for technical.
Did it? Oh dear.
Oh yeah. There. Okay. You're better. You're better. Right, okay. You're back.
Yeah. I was relaxing a bit too much there, away from the microphone.
get angry. Come on. Lean in.
Like Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. I have a question in my head. What's the distance between a leftard and a shitlib? But we can get into that later. I remember in 2020, it was insane because YouTube really, 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 really cracked down. Like they were just taking comments off of my channel that would appear like months later, you know, and when you have a YouTube channel, you get comments that are held for review and then you can check through it and comments would just be ghosted and then they'd pop up 6 months later. So they really turned up the heat in 2020. And I think they went too far. Of course they went too far, but I think they went so far that they turned so many people that were plausibly on their side, right? Plausibly against Trump, let's just say, or plausibly against whatever that dark black fascist authoritarianism that was the specter that the left was using or the regime was using in order to advance itself. But they just went way too far. And I think a lot of people, and I remember when Sargon got kicked off of Patreon in a really weird way, where they went to some video that was posted years ago on this tiny little stream where he said the N-word, but he was calling like white people the N-word. He's like, you're being so even in context, it didn't make sense. And then Patreon kicked him off. So you see that the activists were empowered by the shock to the system that the first Trump election was. And so they went to the head of the fray and they started cracking down left, right, and center on anything that would, not adhere to their ideological purity. But I think that they're so dumb. Like, I think leftard is the correct term because they're so myopic, so narrow-minded, and they didn't really have any ideas other than to forward the ideas. And whoever controls the regime was using them because the regime was gaining power and cementing its power by using that tact. But I think that it just couldn't last. And people such as yourself were axed because you had a certain amount of credibility and you had certain haters, right? The hope not hate. I think one of the first things I saw from you was a talk that you gave. I believe it was you, a talk that you gave about hope not hate targeting you, really explicitly, you know, like the same thing that happens with the Anti-Defamation League here and the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, they're going after certain people that reach a certain level of credibility and then they do that. But if you can fly under the radar or if you figure out ways to touch landmines without clicking them, or at least indicating landmines without stepping on them, then you can get around that. But right now, I don't think they have the will anymore. I think a large part of that has to do with Elon's purchase of X. And then I think that they lost a lot of their really affluent, really intelligent people because of the lockdowns and because of the censorship that happened in 2020.
Do you think that Ukraine... Because to me, it seemed that it sort of COVID was the apex of all this, and then Ukraine was just a step too far. Because I mean, that was like the next thing for the NPC. I remember the memes at the time that you swap out the COVID mask, you put in the Ukraine flag, and you know, that, and it was like that was the next. And for a short while, a couple of months maybe, it worked, and people were all behind it, believing that you know, Zelensky was a trustworthy, good man, telling themselves that. And then it just started to crumble. It was like the energy just, after COVID, the energy just wasn't there.
Righteous fury fatigue.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the next, it's the thing about, I believe in the current thing and I believe in the next current thing. But actually at a certain point, there was a sort of exhaustion, a fatigue. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happened with you when you got kicked off? Like, how did you, to what degree did that like send you into some sort of crisis of like, maybe I am wrong or like maybe you're embattled and stuff. And then how did you kind of recover from such a blow? Like being targeted in that way, being kicked off from your
well, work. I don't want to talk too much about myself, but I will, because you've asked. So I had been preparing for it for a long time. The crisis for me was getting kicked off Twitter in 2018.
That really?
That was a big blow. And some of my viewers now will remember that I was in a terrible state about that. I mean, I was in a terrible state generally, and then that happened, and it really messed me up. But by the time of losing YouTube 3 years, two and a half years later, I'd made peace with it. And so I knew it was going to happen. It was inevitable. And so the day it happened was not a dreadful day. You know, it was just, I got up out of bed, came over to the computer, saw these emails, and I just sort of, and it wasn't I wasn't happy about it, but definitely wasn't messed up about it either. And in a way, it was a relief because it meant, okay, I can stop worrying about this now. It's happened.
Yeah. Sort of Damocles, or what's her name? Susan?
Susan Wojcicki, yeah. And so it prompted me to change how I did things, which I think was good and healthy because I think I had become too fearful, too paralyzed on YouTube because of the threat of censorship, the threat of being deplatformed and all that. And afterwards I felt a lot freer and I started concentrating on Telegram an awful lot. And which was a different thing altogether. It was a very different atmosphere, different approach, that was encouraged by that platform. So mm-hmm. in a way it was a new lease of life. And then the same definitely happened again when I discovered Substack. So, do I miss being at the forefront? Yes. But I also think, well, I had my fill of that. And I don't miss the shitty stuff that comes with it. The attention, including from within your own movement. I mean, there's so many awful people that love to tear someone down.
Yeah.
But then also the enemies on outside as well. When you're no longer at the forefront, you can have an easier time, more relaxed. But at the same time, yeah, of course, if I could choose, yes, I would choose to be back. But yeah, I'm just making the point that it's not wholly bad at all, to be deplatformed. For some people, it is. I mean, we briefly mentioned Stefan Molyneux, and I think that's an interesting case of someone who absolutely failed to adapt to being deplatformed. And I think you have to adapt because you can't continue as if you're still doing the same thing, because you're not. So you have to change. And if you don't, if you keep sort of bloody-mindedly continuing as if you've still got an audience of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, you're on a hiding to nothing. It's just going to crash and burn. It's just going to turn out terribly.
Well, why do you think, and I'm sorry to, I always do this. People have me on their show to talk to me, and then I end up asking them questions.
I had a feeling this would happen.
Yeah, I know. So you know that much about me. But Alex Jones is a case of, like, powering through and not even giving a shit, but maybe he's got a different trajectory.
Well,
maybe he's like kind of an institution. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And he also predated social media. And I think social media was something that he absorbed and adapted to and integrated into what he was doing, but it was always bigger than that. And he was so big that he was able to apparently quite easily survive it. So
yeah.
I mean, I felt sorry for him, and I still do, about what happened to him in 2018, losing everything to the extent that it became a verb, you know, to get Alex Jones. That was awful. That must have been a terrible day for him in his life. But, it's difficult. It's difficult for me to sympathize with him too much because I think as talented as he is, I don't really get the feeling that he's that serious a person or that sincere a person. He's a particular example. But then you could say the same about anyone who gets big. It tends to be because they are primarily good at showmanship. And I'm not even saying this as a sort of jealous complaint about them. I'm just objectively noting that.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they can continue because it doesn't. They're businessmen first and foremost.
Yeah.
But you know, having said that, I don't wish him any ill. I hope he is able to keep going and doing what he wants to do.
Yeah. There's this critique, or I think Yarvin was the first one that I read that said that censorship's not a bad thing for the right. It actually puts a certain amount of selective pressure on the cooker, so the ideas can kind of adapt to the situation and become harder before they kind of go out. And then when it does seem like over the last year specifically, that once Elon took the censorship off of Twitter, that you just kind of have this flood of bad ideas that are right coded, right? And it's mixed in with people who, people who are able to weave through the minefield can package their ideas in such a way that they can escape from their kind of little clade. But when the minefield is just lifted up, then you just have this mad, kind of stream of toads and frogs just ribboning all over the place. And then it kind of muddies the water a little bit. So without that, I think that there's a positive aspect to the fear of that sword kind of hanging over you. I got canceled by YouTube for, just for a week. I interviewed a doctor and a lawyer about what Canada did with the vaccine and how they didn't allow anybody to understand what the vaccine was. And I got curious, well, what is this vaccine? And they actually told me how it operates in the body. And then I get canceled. I get taken off the air. You're not supposed to talk about what this medical intervention does with your body, which is just insane. It's like, why are we not allowed to talk about that? So I'm like, okay, well, I'm not allowed to talk about that, but there's something there. And it seems like over the past, was that 2 years ago? No. It seems like over the past 9 months or so, like they don't really care so much. Like whatever that was with the Pfizer, whatever company was really putting pressure on YouTube to not let that be talked about, it was kind of lifted up a little bit and people are allowed to get that information out there without punishment. But that's a very specific thing. Like that's a medical issue. When we're talking about other spicy issues like race or... I guess race, sex and gender has never been all that policed. I guess transgenderism was kind of policed for a while, but I've done extensive work on that and never really received much in the way of anything other than like soft demonetization for, talking about that because we're talking about body parts and sex and stuff like that. So I understand that advertisers don't want to be appended to that, but it doesn't seem like, I don't know where the censorship is now, at least on YouTube.
Yeah, that's a general feeling, I think, that nobody quite knows, well, what can you get away with now? What are the red lines now? Because, as I said to somebody last night, that there haven't been... The only banning I can think of on YouTube in the last year was Keith Woods quite recently. Now, that's obviously a big thing, it's a big event, but that's the only one. So it's kind of weird to me. It's as if
I can guess what he was talking about that you're not supposed to talk about, or who he was criticizing that you're not supposed to criticize.
Possibly. Okay. I don't know. I don't actually know if he was given a specific reason. But I think that the atmosphere seems to be that people aren't sure. That it might be that they broke the back of like the alt-right and. Culminating with me being banned and Way of the World, Mark Collett, and that's that done now. So I think that could be it, that they're just not they feel that that's done, so they don't need to worry too much about it now. I don't know.
Well, I think that we can't overlook, you brought up Ukraine, and I think Ukraine is a current thing, probably caused some of the activist exhaustion, because it's really hard to care about something that is thousands of miles away and keep that in your head, keep that as your focus when you really don't have any direct ties to it. And then you're watching your economy suffer and your government send billions and billions of dollars to these people. You're like, wait, hold on, what's going on? But the day that's called October 7th now really was fascinating. Tragedy. But at the same time, like, grounds for even more tragedy. But that shook up so much in the discourse, because the left went to the Palestinian side, and a lot of the Jews on the left had to back away. And Jewish people are very, they have high verbal IQ. Let's put it at least that way. So a lot of people on the left were like, wait, hold on, this is my people now. And then in the center, you know, the IDW center, like, there was a fracture there where you're really kind of not supposed to talk about Israel, you know. And then on the right, like, well, like, are the neocon right, and then the kind of like America First right, are the people who want their country to have some sort of ethnic solidarity and that to be okay, or watching like this one country be accepted. And so that really shook up a lot of the things. And I don't think that, I think that they would apply censorship, but they would have to apply censorship on that topic in so many different directions that they would just get under fire from too many people to, like, really implement it.
I think also, whenever I think about October the 7th and the ethnic solidarity that is allowed for Israelis but isn't allowed here, the person I always think about is Jordan Peterson on Twitter, saying, "Give him hell, Benji," or Netanyahu. I can't remember what he said. "Give him hell," and celebrating, celebrating war and mass killing of rather defenseless.
Well, Peterson's the one who popularized like minimum necessary force, like absolute minimum necessary force to get your way back, or to, you know, to stand up to the bullies, and then with that incident, he's like, no, full bloody war, like all out war, because I think he has a religious view of Israel, which is really powerful. And that view of Israel is just really powerful. It's like a totem that you're not supposed to touch. Whenever I get close to it, like, people get really bristly about it, because it's so embedded in the Western imagination for whatever reason that you're just not supposed to touch it. So that's a really interesting thing. And it's it shakes up the whole political left, right, you know, intersectional leftists, or like the right leaning people, in all these different ways, because it's the sacred totem that like fractures our previous allied ideologies.
Yeah. There are so many exceptions that have to be made for Israel that it ends up contradicting things you've said elsewhere. Yeah. But also with the left, suddenly they viewed the Jewish side of that as white. So they were white imperialist oppressors, according to the left's conception, victimizing these poor Palestinians. That was a very interesting moment, which we talked about. A lot of people last millennial talked about this.
Yeah, it was really fresh.
And it led to this thing in American academia where, what was her name?
Claudine Gay?
Claudine Gay, yeah. And several others. She wasn't the only one, but I think people remember her name because it's quite an amusing name. So,
yeah, Harvard. From truth to faking gay.
Yeah.
She eventually like got scolded for...
So you had these people who were diversity placements, who were turning against the institutions, the benefactors who had put them there, and that was swiftly corrected, I have to say, over the last year. I mean, she's lost her position. I think that they all have, and that was a whole interesting thing as well, because it showed that you've got basically how much of an exception Israel is to the usual things. But also, as you say, it cleaved the left in two. Again, it's, I don't know. I don't think that's been dealt with yet. I don't think that's been digested yet, except the activist left who are pro-Palestine have basically been left out in the cold. They're not getting the funding. Greta Thunberg was the darling in Europe of the activist left until she turned against Israel. Mm-hmm. And now she's basically just cancelled, for want of a better word.
Every month or so she gets arrested for a photo op, and not a lot of people.
But now the photo ops are, but now the arrests aren't photo ops. And that's the thing. There was one particular time when she was arrested, and it was aggressive. It was unlike every other time she'd been arrested. Hmm. And you could tell, okay, this time it's genuine. This time it's not a photo op. And I think it was about a year ago now. It was after October 7th. That was a really interesting moment, I think. But the point is that Greta Thunberg is now, I've seen her talked about by leftists as a villain.
Hmm.
Like, kind of like how they talk about J.K. Rowling as an apostate, someone who,
yeah,
she was one of us until she failed. And now she's a bad person.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel that, well, I guess, so Trump gets elected, he's doing something, I don't know exactly what he's doing, but I feel like a definite vibe shift, sorry to use that term, with regard to what's acceptable and what's enshrined. You know, like America, every once in a while, a black person gets manhandled, and that's cause for major amounts of yelling in the streets and calls for societal change, like with Floyd. But Floyd was led up to by a bunch of different incidents, and then there was incidents after Floyd. But since then, like, that's a really big barometer about how powerful the woke thing is, and it just doesn't land anymore. Like, there's not a lot of cause to do that. And I think, I don't know to what extent the Palestinian-Israel conflict is a cause for the activists and stuff, but they're not getting a lot of press. And it seems like people aren't even, like, the mainstream media aren't even really that willing to destroy Trump anymore. They feel like it's really exhausted. Their chips have been played. And so there's not a lot of, it seems like they've lost something. So, but the way that politics works and human attention works and our business works, where like we're looking for the exciting thing. There's always something exciting that's going on. And I think that the political war, the culture war has shifted from not left versus left to the not left fighting or kind of jockeying for positions. And you've had over the past few months in my domain, this kind of war between the classical liberals and the dissident rightists to gatekeep, like, who's, and I don't, there's a whole bunch there, but, that we can talk about, but it's just the amount of energy that's being expended in that shows me that's the next, that's the place forward. Like, this is the real conversation right now, because we've all kind of defeated the woke, but now what do we do? Like, who gets to set the terms of engagement?
Yeah, yeah. I think that, see, I remember the phrase right-wing SJWs from quite a while ago, 2015. Oh, yeah. And that was the first draft of woke right, which we hear now. But it meant essentially exactly the same thing. I don't really know if there's any difference between the two meanings, the two terms. So this has been something that the center-right has done for a long time, because they want to be the edgiest thing. They want to be the most right-wing thing on YouTube. They want to be the ones that are considered dangerous, but also reasonable and sane. So they're opposing the SJWs, but they're not getting crazy. They're not going that far right.
Bad boys in a bow tie.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this has happened before. The woke right, I mean, it's Constantin Kisson and I've forgotten his name, Lindsay.
James Lindsay,
who I agree with Academic Agent on this. I think that James Lindsay is at best a midwit. I mean, I think he's really quite, he's thick. And it comes across sometimes. Sometimes he lets slip the mask, and he says something too hastily, and it's just retarded. It's just stupid. But usually he sticks to you can tell that he's put quite a lot of thought into each of his tweets, trying to demolish the woke right. But then he says something in support of Israel. So, like, as he's just done today. And so, okay, you are a collectivist for Jews. you're a wokist for Jews, but as soon as it's white people, Europeans, Gentiles, then it's the woke right. It's stupid. It's irrational. It's superstitious. It's paranoid. It's hysterical. It's incoherent. It doesn't make sense. You're a fucking fraud. You're just a piece of shit.
Well, yeah, okay. So he's a friend of mine. So, but I'm not going to belabor that or defend him.
Well, those are my views. Yeah, I've never had any contact with James Lindsay. I didn't know you were friends with him. If I had known, I would be much more diplomatic.
No, yeah. Well, and so that all that said, I think it points to the next project. How does so-called liberalism adapt to a post-liberal world? How do we reckon with ethnic solidarity post-90s? Ethnic solidarity, like return to that. There's ways to do of overlapping ethnicities in America. I don't know. I'm not talking. I don't want to talk for your land, because that's a whole other issue that needs its day in court, needs its day in the sun, and needs a lot of attention paid to it. Because from my point of view, if Israel's allowed to have its sovereignty, then Britain, the people of Britain, should be allowed the same amount of solidarity along the same lines. But in America and with the liberal project more broadly, like there's certain things that we were coasting on, because I think post-World War, we had tons of economic growth. We kind of got along. There wasn't a lot of pressure economically, so we could just keep on growing and we could overlook the frictions between these different cultural domains.
Like the Irish, the Germans, and the Italians, and the Anglos kind of thing.
Yeah. And then, and also, you know, I mean, we had race riots and stuff like that, but even like more distant cousins if you want to take that tact with the racial things, like the Hispanics, blacks and whites and all the different varieties of all those different groups, we kind of went along because we were all headed in the same direction. And because the ticker tape was going up and up and up and up and up. But a lot of that is going to fizzle and we're going to enter into hardship. So I don't know if
you say that peaked in the 90s.
I think it felt good in the 90s. I think 2010s were pretty good too. I think it was the economic downturn in 2008 that shocked the system, and then, you know, there was Occupy Wall Street, and then for whatever reason intersectionality gets play, and then we have that absolutely asinine intersectional playbook that came to fruition at Evergreen, but then came to, you know, worldwide fruition in 2020 with the George Floyd thing, trying to put black people on the pedestal and not demanding equal, not just treatment, but expectations for certain behaviors, and not judging people equally. So for some reason, it's really difficult for people to treat strangers with kindness. It takes a lot of intelligence and security to be able to look at somebody who's a different culture than you, you know, a different language than you, and a different look than you, a different skin color than you, and see, connect with them as some sort of equal, and to get along with them. It takes a certain, not just culture, but atmosphere to get along in that way, across these different divisions, across these different differences. And it's really difficult to maintain that. And that is, I think, shaking. Like,
individuals can always do that. And there are certain individuals who are minded to show solidarity with the outsider, to be curious about them, to not see difference, to look beyond that, because it's a sort of... And I don't just mean self-righteously. I mean quite genuinely that they want to look after everyone. They want to overcome barriers and all this. And most of those will be left-wing, but I think there are right-wing people as well who are like that. They want to get out of the parochial, transcend that. So that's always there in some individuals, and they can do fine work as individuals. But in terms of groups, It's extremely difficult to keep two groups coexisting peacefully because there are so many reasons to disagree, so many reasons to compete and come into conflict.
Mm-hmm. And I think what James, and I don't know, he's got a lot of arguments. I respect his intellect too. I see that he makes errors for sure. But
I will repeat that I didn't know you were friends with him. And oh, well, I'm only going by what I see of him on Twitter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So if I'd known you were friends, I would have been much gentler.
I don't want to defend him or anything, but I do think he's a test case for a certain set of assumptions having a difficulty or giving rise to a lot of worry about internecine conflict between ethnic groups. And that that way leads to very bloody territory if we're not very, very careful. And so I really respect the dissonant right and all of its different flavors. I use that term very broadly because they're rethinking things. They're talking about things that you're not supposed to talk about, but they're actually bringing up things that we need to somehow harmonize with the goodwill that we want to maintain, or at least the avoidance of absolute interracial conflict. Even intersexual conflict or intersexual conflict, which is another vector of discourse that I tend to appreciate the gender discourse more than the race discourse more because it's a little safer and it's a little bit more fun for me. But I think that from the liberal point of view,
the same things apply.
You know, but the same things apply.
You've got to accept difference and not deny difference, mm-hmm. but then also come to accommodate difference. Because once you've accepted that people are like the sexes are different, well, then you've got to come to some arrangement so that they can interact. And it's the same with races. I mean, once you accept that they are different, well, then, okay, we can stop the pretense that we're all the same, but now we've got a job to do to work out how to get along together.
And that shakes the foundation of certain liberal assumptions that are really difficult to square without like things getting really rickety. But the fact of the matter is, from my point of view, things are already rickety. So we might as well just like face the music and try to, I mean, basically I keep on calling myself a liberal. I don't really know what I mean by that, but it basically goes back to what you're saying about an inborn kind of openness to be able to connect with a broad swath of human beings. So difference of category is something for me to transcend. I have a creative mind, so I like playing around with categories, but I also know that I'm not the kind of person
This is why you're an interviewer, and it's why you even when you're the interviewee, you can't help but ask questions of the other person. Yeah. I think this is a sign of what you're saying, that you're very inquisitive and empathetic.
Yeah. But the whole world, you know, I'm one kind of aspect of the human creature, and you know, in I was lucky enough to be humbled in my earlier years when I was kind of going down the shitlib path to kind of realize that the conservatives, speaking America, those flyover states, the red countries, they were the ones who were able to show up to work and really get the job done and really cared about family. They're the ones who propagate society and maintain society. And my type is just playing around with ideas that might give up something new. Yeah, you know, right. Might yield something beneficial, but could just yield something malignant too. But I don't have the constitution to be as, you know, conscientious and industrious as other people. So I, you know, in my openness, I'm like, okay, how do we articulate these different kind of political temperaments? And I think that my main criticism with the woke right tactic of dividing the not left is that it's burning bridges, and it's not facilitating beautiful things.
Yeah,
it antagonizes.
It antagonizes.
And then you end up getting people calling you retarded and not even wanting to listen to what you do have to say because you're attacking them. So they're going to go back. It just starts this whole thing that I think is just beside the point. It's not even entertaining.
No, it's not. And you're exactly right. If he hadn't insulted so many people on my side of this debate, then I wouldn't have this animosity towards him. And that is something that he is, I've just got to blame him for it. You know, I've got no reason to dislike him or anyone else. It's just, it's when they are belligerent, then, and have this assumption of superiority, which also attended those who used the right-wing SJWs label 10 years ago. They were convinced that they were right and so clever and so much more better informed and all this. And it's infuriating. And I think everyone knows who I'm talking about. But, you know, he's now wised up to some extent, strangely enough. Yeah. Well, I say wised up. He's come around to my way of thinking to some extent. But at the time, it's that smugness, I think, that is very infuriating. Yeah.
Well, you know, I got my start studying because I was going to Evergreen State College and I saw it happen over the course of 4 years, just this absolute insanity and leading to the most cringiest, like 40 or 50 or 100 hours of video that could possibly be produced. And I was lucky enough to be there and got to share it with people. But very quickly, I'm like, what makes some of the students not go that crazy? You know, and then what makes some of the students go into that total insanity? And then how do they get out of that? Like, how do they change? Under what conditions do people actually change their minds? Like, humiliation only worked for some of them. Because, like, if you're humiliated for being wrong, you're going to be incentivized to go run and hide or double down. So that's not really going to work. And the only thing that that's why my second kind of phase of content was really focusing on the subset of individuals that are called detransitioners, people who generally in their youth glommed onto a trans identity and went to a certain extent down the medicalization path and then figured out that they were living a lie. And in very specific moments over and over and over again in these interviews, these individuals hear a voice that says you're lying to yourself. Something confronts them in their own life, and it's usually like a direct intervention from a higher power, but, you know, take that as you want. But they're told you are lying to yourself. And then from that moment, they actually have to start to unwind and like go through the process of detransition, which depending on how far transitioned they went, like there's no going back from certain levels. But what that shows is that there is in every human being's life, there is a waveform of correction that happens from the inside out. Nobody intervenes with them. Nobody convinces them that they're wrong. Something intervenes within them, like reality catches up with them in a personal way. So the core of what I'm trying to get to in my work is to provide people a place to speak, you know, their ideas, speak their thoughts, and to kind of record where they are in that moment and then come back a couple of years later and see where they are. Because it's how we change over time as human beings and adapt, or people don't adapt. And then you can see that. You can see the darkness. And they serve, unfortunately, and hopefully on a long enough timeline, they do get redeemed, but they serve as kind of moral stories, right? Morality tales that if you don't change your ways, if the world's giving you certain sorts of feedback and you don't change, you get locked away. And I see that's why I have a problem with the name calling, the name slinging, and the partitioning of people and with the woke right thing. It's like, okay, yeah, you're gonna section yourself off. I'm not just talking about James, I'm talking about all the people who've followed his lead on this. We're gonna section off this people in really ill-defined terms and talk about them in very ill-defined, ambiguous terms. So nobody's actually interacting with these people anymore, but we're going to cut them off, right? Like that's the move. We're going to cut them off from the discourse. We're going to tell them, we're going to push them out of the Overton window. But the only thing that you actually do when you do that is cut yourself off. Like that's all you do. It's like you just end up boxed away.
Yes. Yes. I think it could have happened if it could have worked. If he'd been bigger and his opponents had been smaller, you know, so, and if this had happened a couple of years ago, maybe, but at this point it's too late. And so I think the effect then is to ostracize himself. I mean, I know he's got lots of followers and they'll still follow him, and that tends to be the way of it.
Well, him aside, like is what I'm still open to is his career, his critique correct, or can it be a corrective to the people he's calling woke right. And that's what Aaron had me on his show, Aaron McIntyre, great guy. He had me on his show to talk about like the changing tides in the IDW. And I used that opportunity.
I should just say for anyone who doesn't know, that's the intellectual dark web. Isn't
yeah.
It?
Or yeah. Dork web. Yeah. That was the kind of like the centrist salon of 2017 to about 2020, and they all kind of went their own ways. It has its own history and stuff, but I wanted to use that opportunity to talk to his audience, like with the Daryl Cooper went on Tucker. Tucker like really praised him and ticked off a lot of the centrist people who kind of seemed like they were a little bit envious of Daryl, whatever. But like Daryl said some things that are spicy. He challenged like some of the core foundational myths of our time. And I think it was actually very good that he did that because he started a discussion that I hadn't seen going on. But then people went through his Twitter and saw some kind of mustached man tweets, right? And, you know, some sort of like some edgy mid-century Germans aren't the worst thing in the world kind of things. And so, which again might deaden that as like the end-all be-all of how we interpret history. But at the same time, It's okay when we're in our little clades and our little silos and we have a code and we're kind of being edgy, we're saying the N-word or whatever it is, right? Which works to, I see it when I started to investigate like the dissident right, I confronted some openly racist stuff. I'm like, whoa. And then I realized there was a tactic of using that so people couldn't like actually enter the conversation. If your skin was too thin on this level, you're not ready to have this conversation. It was a way to insulate the silo. But the thing is, any idea on the other side of that line isn't really going to get traction in the broader sphere until it's cleaned up of those kind of codes and stuff like that. So I think with the woke right stuff, if there's anything to take from that, from the dissident right, there might be something about modifying the language or looking at, like, to what degree does identity politics actually matter? Like, what is its place? Is it rampant? Is it, like, is that how we're going to base our ideology? Or is that just one thing that we had to push against and maybe over-italicize because it was underrepresented, and so we've overrepresented it now, but it's part of a bigger constellation. Like, is there more development in the dissident right that this could spark and spur? That's where I think the creative aspect of the little culture war is.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I would be willing to have a debate with James Lindsay to see what could we agree on and what is the core of his disagreement with identity, but white identity politics, for example. And maybe he would educate me and make me realize that this is all very stupid and short-sighted and whatever. Or maybe I would get through to him. Obviously, both of us would have a vested interest in being right and not being proven wrong.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That would be the difficulty there. But I would be open to that. I'm quite happy to discuss these ideas with people because I'm very confident about them. I mean, If Israel can fight for its existence, then every other group should be able to fight for its existence. Because otherwise, there's some bizarre exception going on there.
Yeah,
it doesn't make much sense.
Or global homo, except for certain things. There's a lot of discourse around it, and I don't enjoy the belligerence, unless it's against the left. I mean, I guess I'm kind of Charles Haywood, and I mean, like, no enemies to the, I'm not necessarily no enemies to the right, but I'm like all guns on the left, you know, like all guns firing on the left until it can humble itself and maybe like enter into like some sort of discourse that's actually generative rather than totalitarian.
Yeah. See, this is what I've always said for years now, that we've got enough enemies on the outside. So we really shouldn't be trying to weaken each other, sabotage each other, and all this. But, you know, there are a lot of disagreeable personalities who find that very disagreeable. Yeah, they don't like that idea. They want to fight each other. And this is a problem with social media, that there's always something to be gained by defeating the next person, the person standing next to you. Because then you've discredited him, so now you've got his his fans, his followers, so to speak. So there's always something to gain from infighting. It's a problem. It's a real problem because the overall effect is demoralization, because most people don't like seeing figures fighting or taking the piss out of each other, betraying each other, this kind of thing. The effect that it has really is to demoralize and amuse our enemies, amuse our mutual enemies. Yeah. You know, that's who really, and I've said this for years, that our enemies laugh when we fight each other. So could you not do it?
Can't we all just go, are you the Rodney King of the dissident right? Is that your mantle? Like,
hippie, too nice, too nice for my own good sometimes. But yeah, I mean, it's just common sense, really. Don't give your enemies, don't do your enemies' work for them. And that doesn't mean we can't disagree. Disagree, but do it politely.
There's a higher cause, right? Sorry, what?
It's a bit funny, given that I'm saying to be polite, but given what I said about James Lindsay earlier, but I don't really consider him part of my milieu. So there we go. Yeah. But yeah. All right.
Yeah. Well, there's I guess it's just kind of like a maturity issue. If disagreement, if it's just about being right, I think it's a very low level kind of purpose to be right or be correct, because you're only going to be correct about one thing for one period of time in a narrow way. I think if the goal is something higher than being right, or once people start declaring that they want to not just seek the truth or seek the beautiful or seek the good, but they start to claim that they have the path to those things, then everything that they're doing just kind of goes back into themselves. Like, it's no longer about something greater than themselves and something that is where the real possibility is and stuff. So I think it's fun to argue and it's fun to watch those blood sports or whatever, those back and forths. But if whenever I see that on Twitter and I sense that one or both of those parties aren't really aimed at like coming to some sort of formulation that's a refinement of their positions before they entered into that, but rather just to dominate the other person, it's like, I lose all sorts of interests in that.
Yeah.
And I think, kind of respect in the people who are participating in that.
Yeah. I think like in my own case, my channel was very, the way I see it, the way sort of my mythology of it is that it was very innocent and sort of open-minded until for the first 8 months. And then in August 2014, the ISIS beheadings happened, the Rotherham report was published, and the Ferguson riots happened, all in 1 month. And it really shook me. And thereafter, I was much more rigid, ideological, I guess. Well, not even ideological, just committed to this one cause, that this race really matters. And clearly, demonstrably, it does. Three terrible things have just happened. Mm-hmm. And so thereafter, there was less innocence in my work. And I really do miss the first 8 months. That was of 2014. That's what I regard as this sort of cozy beginning of my channel. And thereafter, it was more, as I say, rigid. And I think, so I can understand what you're saying, that when you approach something with an open mind and, you know, goodwill, and you're not claiming to have all the answers, all this kind of thing, it's a more pleasant atmosphere. Yeah. But at the same time, we are in a desperate situation. That's maybe not from your perspective, but certainly from my perspective.
No, I see that. You know,
So in a way, to remain innocent and not be committed is irresponsible.
No, yeah, you're right. No, that commitment. But the thing is, I don't know. The thing is, like, you gained a position of leadership in your community, right? So whatever you're feeling is magnified by the attention that is on you. And then, so if you get rigid or boxed into an urgent mindset, it'll reverberate back to you. Right. So it when you're put into that position with a lot of eyes on you and you giving voice to things, you always kind of have like reserve a place for innocence in you, or like, and I think the path to that is just have a little bit of humility. I don't mean to, I hope this doesn't sound like I'm giving you advice or anything like that, but I can see that when people are thrust into that position, like I'm the thought leader and we're at war, like very few men are actually really good leaders. There's a lot of thought people, there's a lot of charismatic people, there's a lot of people who can describe things infinitely well. But leadership is its own quality, and leadership has this ability to engage with that issue, engage with that fight, but leave like space for home, right? Like leave space for what we're fighting for, which is where innocence can be fostered and protected, and life can be raised and grown, and young people can be trained. Right.
I think you've got to remember what you're fighting for, not just what you're fighting against. In other words, you've got to remain motivated by love rather than hate. And I hate that. That obviously sounds very hippie-ish, but you know what I mean.
You're allowed to be hippie-ish during Christmas time, all right? This is the season of love, okay?
Hopefully. If at any time of the year I can get away with that. But it's a real thing, though, because I've known people who... I think a few people who called themselves white nationalists, but I think they hated the enemy more than they loved the white race, or more than they loved their own people, and it does twist you, it does distort, it sort of spoils a person over time. I think.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really know where to go from there. We're talking about so many different things at once.
are we wrapping up at the top of the hour? It's to the top of the hour. Do you have another guest coming on?
Yes. Well, I do, yes. I did say it would go for about 60 minutes. Okay, there is...
I'm not rushing at all, but I just want to be aware.
No. There is one super chat here. Someone asks, what do you think of Brett Weinstein? We sort of skirted over the Evergreen episode. I don't know if you'd like to say more about that, but what do you think about Brett Weinstein?
I have deep respect for Brett as a communicator and somebody who's totally willing to put himself in the line of fire. And I've seen him display immense amounts of courage and also adaptation when he's put in a position where maybe he's kind of wrong and he has to admit that he's wrong, right? He was okay with masks. I don't know. He gets slandered or criticized for things that he said at certain points in time. And then he rethought through the evidence and he corrected himself. And he's got an enormous ability to correct himself given enough time, right? And given the right amount of input. But anybody who reaches that level of attention is going to have, not personality issues, but just issues with communication. And I think he's a professor first, not a PR person. And he was put into a lot of the IDW, Jordan Peterson, Brett and Eric Weinstein, Heather, like all these guys, even Peter and James and Helen, they're really good. They're really academic. They're really very smart, very well read. They can put in the work and stuff. But, every once in a while, they'll come up with a term that's really cringe because they're not PR people, They're not poets, That's not what they're supposed to do. And so you see some foibles and stuff like that. But I see Brett as somebody who's able to admit mistakes and then pivot and make good on the truth and to evolve over time, which is something that I honor anybody who's engaged, especially in what we're involved in broadly, even everybody that's involved in social media. We're involved in this tremendous experiment that... And we're putting our reputations on the line. We're putting our lives on the line to a certain degree. I mean, we're not like necessarily getting shot unless that swatting actually goes all the way. But we're opening ourselves up to immense amount of analysis for future generations and present generations. Yeah, and to undergo like what you did, like what you kind of mentioned, like you had like a crisis when you got kicked off of Twitter, you get this feedback and you're like, whoa, what is going on? And you get it. It's an opportunity to kind of adapt and to kind of reassess. And I think that one of the things I hope we're growing out of with the internet is that people aren't what they said 10 years ago. People aren't what they're saying right now. People, what they're saying, what they're exposing about themselves is part of like this really shape-shifting timeline, and we're much greater than our tweets, right? But over time, we can use these little tiny fractures of information to make connection with each other and to to really learn what we are, who we are, and respond to that in a way that's more novelistic in shape rather than cartoonish. And I think that's another reason why I do these long form interviews, is to especially repeated interviews with people, is to show that the human being is much greater than where they even think they are, what even they believe at that moment, because they eventually change. And if they don't change, something is broken or something is wrong. And it that's really hard to balance with what you're saying. Like, you have to have convictions. You have to say, no, this is the hill that I'm dying on. It's wrong to mutilate children, right? It's wrong to sacrifice children, right? And I'm not going to stand up for that. And I think it's really important to have those baseline things, to really have integrity on certain issues. But it's interesting to watch people's ego is always getting in the way of them, because there's so much attention that they, just because they're right about one thing, they think that they're right, period. And you have to be better than that.
Yeah. I think that social media, I mean, people will probably be analyzing how the human being reacted to social media for a long time yet. I don't think we've really got to grips with it yet, but one aspect of it is, and I can speak from my own personal experience, that you come to identify with. You see, the thing is, I was always very direct, so there was no sort of persona. I'm just, you know, this is just me, and it always was. But I came to think that I needed my Twitter. The big difference in the reactions to losing Twitter and losing YouTube was, by the time I lost YouTube, I knew that I didn't need it. It wasn't an integral part of myself. It was a tool that I had and that I was using. But at the time of losing Twitter, I thought, it was sort of fundamental. It was like a part of me, you know, that was being denied. I think that is an unhealthy aspect of social media, that people come to really identify with their channel, their profile, their online thing. And that obviously is going to be reinforced if they've got some sort of persona, which isn't their real, because then it's a real, another level of fakery, where you're pretending to be the person that people see on their screen, and the person that people think they know and is their friend. Well, that's all fake. Well, then if you're really committed to that thing, then it's extremely unhealthy.
Well, there's ContraPoints, who I think is the exemplar of audience capture in a certain way, or the ability for that person to produce such excellently produced persona, and even play around with the persona, lock them in, and you see that it locked them in. They haven't been able to create much anymore. They rose to prominence, and it would be great to see like kind of a transformation. Because I think that like there's always that flashing cursor until we're dead. There's always we can always write a new sentence, you know, like that's the quickness of this medium's, like there's always like life is still happening. You can still write something new. Like there's still a blank page. There's still a canvas, right? So I think that the people who do get caught into their persona, you can really see it. And for some reason, I think that's a great kind of crucible for the human being to go through that they hadn't had to go through before now. And so I think that it'll show like another aspect of the artist or the life of the artist, if people can surmount that. I think we all do. I think even I tried to be a straight person, but I felt a persona and I had to break away from it. I felt that clinging to me. But at the same time, you kind of need to be familiar to people. So it's like always kind of like, it's like your satanic reflection in the mirror, you know, when you're producing yourself, you have to kind of have distance, but playfulness with it.
I think it can be stultifying. The expectations of your audience can be sort of suffocating, and it's a weight bearing down on you. I definitely felt that at various times. And in that sense, I think that being banned from YouTube was a good thing for me, because it released all of that tension.
Yeah.
It was quite nice at the time.
What happened to all your work?
Sorry?
What happened to all your work? Is it still around?
No, and I've got it, because I always retained everything. I'm always amazed by people who don't keep a copy of every video they've done. Yeah. It's not, I mean, for God's sake, you know, hard drives cost nothing. So I've got everything archived, but most of them aren't on online. And actually, I really, and this was something that was awful. And a lot of people did it. A lot of people felt that they, in order to protect their channel from being shut down, they had to delete a lot of their videos. So I had already deleted a lot of my early videos by the time the channel got shut down. And I should have known. I should have known this won't save me. They're coming for me. They're not coming for the video. They don't give a shit what's on in any particular video. It's me. And that's absolutely correct. When they ban me personally, yeah. Life. So it's not just that channel. I mean, if I were to create a gardening channel on YouTube now, something completely innocuous, it would get shut down because it's me. That's what they said.
Have you tried? It'll change?
I actually did have another. I'd actually forgotten about this. Before Millennial Woes, I did create, 3 years earlier, I created a channel that was actually my first YouTube channel. And it was purely for advertising a TV series that I'd discovered, and I fell in love with it. It was an obscure TV series, so I wanted to publicize it. I wanted more people to find it. So I made these little adverts for it, and then I created this channel and uploaded them on there. And then I forgot all about it. and then it survived the banning of Millennial Woes and all that. Somehow they didn't get, because it was the same email address was used, and yet they didn't associate the two somehow. And they shut down all three of my Millennial Woes channels. And then 2 years later, I think about a year ago now, then this channel, this prehistoric channel, got shut down as well.
Oh,
they finally got around to it. Huh. And I don't know. I still don't know if it was connected in any way to Millennial Woes, or they just did it for a different reason. They said it was spam and deceptive practices, which could well be. Okay, this is a product you're advertising that isn't yours. It's this DVD company's. So it's spam. It's deceptive. That might have genuinely been why they deleted it, and it had nothing to do with Millennial Woes. I don't know. But yeah, it's a funny thing that pre-existed and survived, and I'd really forgotten all about it until it got shut down and I got this email saying so. But anyway, I can't remember how that came up.
I think it would be great to have your stuff available to people, especially your days of innocence and then your days of corruption, and just to have that charted out. I know that Substack allows videos.
I wouldn't say I was corrupted. I would just say that it was more ideological than I would be happy with. You know, when I look at my videos now from 2017, some of them are good. I mean, I'm very proud of. I did a speech about Withnell and I was still very proud of that. But some of them, I think, bloody hell, how many times can you use the word white in 10 minutes? That kind of thing does rather shock me now, because it seems very sort of doctrinaire and sort of hollow.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. So in that sense, I do feel I was kind of letting myself down in that sense. But I felt that there was a sort of mission and there was a movement. And I was very prominent in the movement, and I did feel a responsibility to it. So that was very corrupt. I don't think it was corrupt, but it was kind of, as I say, a bit dehumanizing, sort of hollow. Compared to the early days when I was doing videos about the need to keep public libraries and the better recycling and this kind of thing. a book from 1914 that I discovered, this kind of thing, which was very innocent and very genuine as well. And so that's the stuff that I remember most fondly. But at the same time, the stuff that happened after that made me. So, you know, I can't regret it.
What's the one that you said, Withnell and I? That's the one you're really proud of?
Yeah, it was in 2017. Yeah, it was a speech I gave in London. Yeah.
Is that still around?
It will. It is. It's on my Odyssey channel, yeah.
Okay. I'll check that out.
When I created the Odyssey channel, I put up maybe about 10 videos that I thought were my best ones, the ones that I was most proud of at that time. But as you see, you keep evolving, you keep changing. And that is an interesting thing about, again, with being deplatformed, because every platform works differently. So every platform brings something else out of you. Like, for example, when I got banned from Twitter, I started an Instagram. And that was always very separate from, eventually it got banned as well. But while it lived, it was very different from everything else, you know. It, and then Substack again, to the extent that it took me some time to get used to find my feet on there, like 6 months, because you're not, it's asking you to behave differently. It's not really accommodating the same stuff that you would have done on YouTube. So, and same with Telegram as well. Yeah. So I do think you're right that people keep evolving, and it's right that they do. And if they don't, and this is the thing about, you know, some people move around, they travel. I don't, but obviously this is why different platforms can be useful, because they ask different things of you. But see, this has ended up being you interviewing me. It's not what I wanted to be aware of that, so that I would be on the loop.
Warned.
Yeah.
Such it is. Yeah. Well, it's really good to get to know you in this context, in this format. And I do want you on my channel if you have time. Once you're done with your long party, your Saturnalia. How does millennial crescendo, how does it climax? Is there some weird ritual that happens at the end?
Have you heard of Morgoth?
Yes, I know Morgoth. I just discovered he follows me. Yeah. I'm actually like reading his Twitter right now, or before we joined.
The general structure is interviews for a night through to Christmas. And then this year there's going to be hangouts, group hangouts after that for a few days. And then there'll be Morgoth, which tends to be quite a long stream. Mm-hmm. 1 year, I think it was 7.5 hours long, which I had never expected. it came as a surprise, but he just kept talking.
Yeah.
So it was fine. It was good. And then I think the year after that, last year, I think it was about 5.5 hours. So this year, who knows? But that tends to be the crescendo. And then finally, there's the outro AMA, just me on my own. So that's the structure of Millennial.
Hmm.
So, yes, after that, I'd be happy to appear on your channel if you're up for that.
No, I am.
Okay. All right, excellent. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say? But let me just check if there are any other questions for you, but I'm afraid there aren't. Okay. So is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
In closing, I had no idea what we're going to talk about. I was nervous. But you're like, what? It's going to happen. Whatever's going to happen, I'm just going to try to show up and be present. And it was good conversation. It felt like we had that thing happen in a conversation where, like, we went through something together. It was cool. I hope the audience enjoys it too. And I guess you have links to all my work down there in the description. Benjamin A. Boyce, Twitter, YouTube.
Yes, they're all there.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Well, I will be back in about 45 minutes. With the next stream, which I think is the Good Old Boys, yes.
Oh, they're fun.
Right, okay. I think it'll be quite, I get the feeling it might be quite raucous. Yeah. But I'm looking forward to that. In the meantime, Benjamin Boyce, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you very much, Colin. Have a good season.
All right, thank you. I'll see you all later. Bye-bye for now.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.